Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Hourly developments in the Russian invasion of Ukraine on multiple fronts, on the ground and on the economic front, as Europe and the United States continue to ratchet up financial penalties on Russia. Russian oil is the next big target, and the Biden administration has made a sudden about-face. On Thursday last week, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said the Biden administration would not sanction Russian oil.
We don't have a strategic interest in reducing the global supply of energy. That would raise prices at the gas pump for the American people around the world because it would reduce the supply available. And it's as simple as less supply raises prices. And that is certainly a big factor for the president at this moment. It also has the potential to pad the pockets of President Putin, which is exactly what we are not trying to do.
That was Thursday. Congress pushed back. On Sunday, Republican Representative Michael McCaul of Texas was in Poland, part of a bipartisan delegation visiting the Poland-Ukraine border.
Please tell the President of the United States to at least stop the imports of Russian energy that are fueling the slaughter and frankly, in violation of the Geneva Convention as a war crime. And it's 8% of our imports, but we can at least do that.
McCaul there on CNN. A bipartisan group of powerful lawmakers from the House Ways and Means Committee also sought to fast-track legislation that would halt U.S. imports of Russian oil. And on Monday, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi put it rather plainly.
Ban it.
Ban the oil.
Ban the oil come from Russia. Yep.
Well, this morning, President Biden completed that about-face and announced that the U.S. will ban Russian energy imports.
We're moving forward with this ban, understanding that many of our European allies and partners may not be in a position to join us. The United States produces far more oil domestically than all the European countries combined. In fact, we're a net exporter of energy. So we can take this step when others cannot. But we're working closely with Europe and our partners to develop a long-term strategy to reduce their dependence on Russian energy as well.
Russia is the EU's largest supplier of oil and gas. And while Biden's announcement today marks the first divergence between the U.S. and the EU in their Russia response, the two have been in lockstep over the past 2 weeks, unleashing an unprecedented avalanche of sanctions against Moscow immediately after Russia launched its Ukrainian offensive. Well, this weekend, Russian President Vladimir Putin called the historic penalties, quote, akin to an act of war. So that's our focus today. Are sanctions, financial penalties, import bans, asset seizures and the like effectively economic war? And if it is, it's an arsenal that's been used before, but to what end? Does economic war work to stop a physical war on the ground? Let's start with Patricia Cohen. She's global economics correspondent for The New York Times, and she joins us from London. Patricia, welcome.
Thank you, Meg. Now, how are you?
I'm well, and thank you so much for joining us. Can I just get your first thoughts on the potential global impact, if any, of the Biden administration's expected announcement on banning Russian oil imports into the United States?
So I think, as you mentioned in your introduction, Russian exports of oil to the United States are a minute fraction. They're really not a crucial part of the U.S. energy supply. The reason that Biden, in the first place, exempted energy exports from Russia was basically at the behest of Europe, which, as you mentioned, you know, is a huge consumer of that. You know, it will raise the price a little bit in the sense in the U.S., but that is really, I think, just political pressures of in Washington, D.C. that's happening in Congress there, where, you know, everybody wants to kind of put on their little badge to show how that they're even more anti-Russia than the next person.
Yeah. It may be safe to say also that because U.S. imports of Russian oil products is so much lower than it is in the European Union, that maybe a U.S. ban might not have, a searing economic effect in Russia. But could it produce some additional pressure on the European Union?
I don't know that it produces more pressure on the European Union in the sense that I think the European Union is going to make that decision. And as you mentioned before, things are changing day to day, hour to hour. I had written about how I think the Russians were surprised by the severity of the sanctions. I think the European powers themselves were surprised by the severity of the sanctions. I don't think any of those countries a few days earlier before they enacted all of these global financial sanctions expected to go as far as they did.
Yeah. So let's, I mean, the oil story is just the latest chapter in this. Patricia Cohen, let's go back.
Yes, the oil story. The oil story is the latest chapter. And also, I mean, oil prices already are going crazy because there's just so much volatility and uncertainty in terms of what's going to happen and where supply is coming from. And then you have, you know, there's this whole process that you have happening of, you have the official sanctions, right, that governments have imposed. But then what happens is a kind of chilling effect where companies themselves begin to make a decision to pull out of Russia, even though they're not under, you know, law to do that. And that's what we're seeing with oil companies right now and what Shell announced this morning and BP has announced in terms of withdrawing from its Russian investments. So, you know, the energy market is incredibly volatile and unstable right now.
And the only people who truly love volatility are short sellers, I'd say. But let's go back and get that bigger picture, though, because, again, these sanctions, as you said, they came so quickly that I'll say I personally find it difficult to keep up with what has happened. So can you just remind us, in those first days after Russia launched its attack, what were some of the sanctions and economic penalties, we'll start with Europe, that Europe laid onto Russia?
Well, I think, let me put it this way. Look, there's you know, dozens of different countries that have put on sanctions that have varied somewhat from each other. There has been, you know, hundreds of individuals that are affected. There's differences, but let me just put them in kind of three big categories that I think would be most helpful to understand what's going on. So I think the most surprising and by far the most potentially powerful was the decision to, in essence, freeze the assets of the Russian Central Bank. Even though what Putin had done in order to, you know, in a sense, sanction-proof Russia was build up a huge pile of reserves in foreign currency, foreign currency exchange reserves, and, you know, $643 billion. But, you know, roughly half of that, even though it's owned by Russia, is essentially under the control of banks in the U.S., in Europe, in Canada, et cetera. And so those assets are frozen. So they actually can't use. Now, this is an incredibly powerful tool. And I've spoken to some economists to actually say this, if you use this tool and it destabilizes or brings a collapse of the currency, the Russian ruble, you know, that you could literally destroy an economy and that we should be careful about how far we want to take this. But that really is what is causing the most shockwaves. Then the second piece, which we've all heard about, this SWIFT, you know, this messaging system, this connection of financial institutions, which probably nobody ever heard of before, but now suddenly everybody's an expert in. But so Russian banks essentially have been locked out of using that, which means it just makes it very difficult to make payments back and forth, even if you were allowed to. And then the third piece is basically preventing any companies from doing business with Russia. And this can be very powerful, not only because of direct sanctions that say, you know, you're not allowed to sell them parts for their cell phones, for their military equipment, you know, and things like that, but what's called secondary sanctions, which is that even companies that may not be directly affected don't want to kind of come under the scrutiny of U.S. Treasury Department that they may be involved with. So there's a kind of ripple effect from those. And those are really the baskets, I think, in terms of thinking about sanctions and why they're working right now.
And for historical context, have we seen, I mean, sanctions have obviously been used in different situations before, but have we seen this many, this severe, so quickly launched against a specific nation by so many members of the international community?
Right. Well, you know, it's funny, in the lead up to all of this, I talked to several economists and people who had studied sanctions, and pretty much the consensus is, well, you know, they have limited impact, and it really depends on what is the goal that you're trying to do. And oftentimes, if you're trying to get something very specific, that they could possibly have an impact. But if it's something that the country sees as, you know, really crucial to its survival, then possibly not. The thing that's different, though, about these sanctions, which is maybe a little bit hard for people to understand, but, you know, part of the reason that they are so powerful now has to do with this kind of modern financial system that we have now, where, you know, everything is kept in kind of electronic digital records. And so, you know, this kind of reach is very much a function of a very modern global financial system that is dominated the West, and you know, in a digitized world that didn't necessarily exist decades ago.
Fascinating. Well, Patricia Cohen, global economics correspondent for The New York Times, with us from London. Patricia, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We are talking this hour about the totality of the sanctions that the international community has levied on Russia in the wake of Russia's attack on Ukraine. And this question, does it amount to an act of economic warfare? And if so, does economic war work to help stymie a physical war on the ground? We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're taking a close look at the totality of economic sanctions and financial penalties that the international community has levied on Russia in the wake of Russia's attack on Ukraine. And we're asking this question, is it essentially a form of economic warfare? And if so, to what end? What is the goal here? And is it an effective form of economic warfare to change the reality of physical war on the ground? Let's bring into the conversation Josh Lipsky. He's director of the Atlantic Council's Geoeconomic Center, and he joins us from Washington. Josh, welcome.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
Also with us today is Timothy Fry. He's a professor of post-Soviet foreign policy at Columbia University. He joins us from New York. Professor Fry, welcome to you.
Thank you for the invitation.
I would like to get just your both of your reactions to what Vladimir Putin said over the weekend. He insists that the sanctions are, you know, in his words, quote, akin to economic war. So, Professor Fry, let me start with you. Is it?
So
I don't like this framing at all from President Putin. Economic sanctions are causing a lot of pain in Russia, but they're not killing Russians. I mean, war is killing Ukrainians. I think when we look at the totality of losses in Ukraine, that is war. Economic sanctions are, you know, part of a whole package of coercive elements that can be used to try to change a country's behavior. But I think we should distinguish between actual war, which is what we see in Ukraine, and economic sanctions, which are being levied against Russia.
Mm, point taken. And, you know, I'm not by framing it the way we are, it's not an affirmation of what Putin said, but rather an exploration thereof, because these are huge, unprecedented sort of global actions. And Josh Lipsky, I mean, tell us what you think about what Putin said and also your thoughts on sort of how large the international cooperation has been targeting Russia with these sanctions.
Well, you know, I would disagree slightly, and I am also uncomfortable with the framing in terms of warfare, but this is as close to akin to warfare as you can come in the economic context. And when we think about what we heard at the beginning from Patricia Cohen, close to $400 billion of Russian money, as they think about it, and it is Russian money, was taken away from their bank account overnight. And if you put that in context, that's the size of Austria's entire economy removed from your bank account with flipping a switch. So from Putin's perspective, it's a version of economic warfare. And if we think about the arc of these tools over a 20-year period, go back to post 9/11, these sanctions tools were escalated as a way to go after terrorist financing, but only complementary to military action that was happening. Then you go to Iran 10 years later, sanctions were part of maximum pressure to bring them to the table, but the threat of force was always in the background. Now sanctions are the only weapon, and it's a significant weapon, but the threat of military force is not there. And I think that's a very interesting development in the arc of the use of these tools. And it's unprecedented to have the G7 sanctioning a G20 economy, the 11th largest in the world, and basically isolating them from the global financial system, causing panic at the bank, causing financial distress within the economy, limiting medical supplies and access to technology. Is that war? Is it not? I don't know. But it's blurring the lines in a way we haven't seen before.
Professor Fry, do you want to respond to that?
No, I agree. These sanctions are unprecedented. And Switzerland, you know, the paragon of neutrality, is signing up for the sanctions. So I, you know, fully agree with that. And, you know, we should recognize that the Russian elites were really caught off guard by these economic sanctions. Oligarchs weren't able to get their yachts back to port. And the mass public has really no real sense of the extent to which Russia, thanks in large part due to the sanctions and the withdrawal of corporates and the withdrawal of participation in various cultural and sporting activities, the extent to which Russia is really becoming a pariah nation. So, yes, these sanctions are unprecedented in scope and scale. And I don't think that, you know, I'm not trying to minimize that at all. So I agree in the main with the point made.
So, you know, we're going to, in my mind, a tool is only as effective as the stated purpose to use that tool. And we're going to talk about what the goals may or may not be for these, you know, these historic sanctions against Russia. We'll talk about that in a second. But I mean, perhaps it's stating the obvious, but is it not actually a step forward to turn to economic tools versus, you know, engaging in a hot war, the international community and get further engaging in a hot war on the ground in Ukraine? Josh Lipsky?
Well, you know, that's a complicated question because this is asymmetric, right? Russia is waging a military war in Ukraine and people are dying every day. And we are responding with economic tools. And those are a blunt instrument that affect primarily the everyday Russians who will see their savings evaporate, who see high interest rates, who see inflation, higher food prices, lack of access to basic goods, inability to access their money. So the question is, if you think about response and counter response, yes, is it is it good we are not fighting World War III? Of course. But are we fighting on an asymmetric playing field? I think the answer is yes. And who's really being punished from the sanctions? And the idea, and of course we'll get to this, is that we'll put enough domestic pressure on Putin to either change course or just inflict enough pain to destabilize. But to do that, you have to destabilize and put the entire Russian economy into akin to a depression. And so we have to think carefully about those choices and the ripple effects, both in Russia and then on the global economy.
But isn't the asymmetric nature of it, and again, I'm not even sure if asymmetric is the right word, right? Because to your point, it's apples and oranges, but the massive economic punishment that's being met upon Russia, yes, it's the Russian people are experiencing it, but isn't the international community also saying, well, then this is the consequence of invading a sovereign nation?
Yes, this is the consequence and the punishment for invading a sovereign nation, that your economy will be isolated from the global financial system, an economy that's been integrated into it for over 30 years. So that is the punishment. The question is, will Putin feel the pain from that? And will that change course? I think that's a much different and harder question to answer.
Yeah. Timothy Fry, what do you think?
Sure. So I did some research on Russian public opinion towards the economic sanctions after, you know, the annexation of Crimea. These were targeted sanctions on the Russian elites. And what I found was the Russian public had a worse opinion of the United States and Europe after both levied sanctions on Russia. But there wasn't a backlash in support of President Putin, as many people expected. Ordinary Russians blamed the Russian government for the bad economic performance, you know, fully recognizing that the targeted sanctions were specifically going after elites and corporate entities and didn't really affect them so much. What we're seeing now is the spillover effects that have led to the currency going from 75 rubles to the dollar to 140 rubles to the dollar. And as we're starting to see some large factories, you know, seize up and stop production because they don't have access to microprocessors, a question that's going to be really important to watch is whether Russians blame Vladimir Putin for inviting the sanctions, or do they blame the West for actually levying the sanctions. And that's very difficult to predict. Russian public opinion has not generally been in support of the introduction of Russian troops into Ukraine. You know, this decade of polling data, you know, to bear this out. Now that the troops are actually there, though, I'm sure that there will be, you know, patriotic elements within Russia who rally around President Putin. And we'll just have to see how long that lasts.
So the international community, though, they haven't said this explicitly, but I imagine the European Union, the United States are hoping that ultimately the Russian people blame Vladimir Putin. But that sounds like that's not at all a guaranteed bet to make, Timothy Fry.
No, it's not a guaranteed bet at all, but it is a possibility. Remember, this was a decision taken by a single individual, likely in conversation with maybe six or seven other members of the Security Council. So there was no prior elite buy-in. And Russian foreign policy elites for months had been telling us, oh, this is all just a bluff. Putin's going to back down. We're not the kind of country that invades without provocation. And the Russian public has just been, you know, completely caught off guard. So it's difficult to know how the public is going to respond. One way the sanctions might work is not so much that they get elites to turn and, you know, in classic sense of ganging up on President Putin. A likely option is that Russia just becomes very difficult to govern. As the currency, you know, collapses, as, you know, factories seize up, the political consequences are difficult to predict. Putin has not been a leader who's been willing to tolerate a lot of domestic political instability. So this fear of the simple ungovernability of Russia might be an important constraint.
Interesting. Okay, so Josh Lipsky, let's dive even further more deeply into this. I can't recall, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I can't recall President Biden or members of the EU saying explicitly, like, here are the goals of the sanctions that we're hitting Russia with. But is there sort of this hope that we will make life difficult for that the goal is will make life difficult for Russians or the Russian elite at least, and so therefore they will rise up and overthrow Vladimir Putin. I mean, is regime change the sort of unspoken goal here?
Well, there could be different goals from the U.S. and the EU, as you point out. It hasn't been entirely clear what the end game is here or what an off-ramp is for the sanctions, because typically when these are put on, they're very hard to come off, no matter what sort of process we go into in the coming weeks and months in Ukraine. But the one thing we have heard from the White House that I think is important is they want to take down the ruble. And they've been very specific about that piece of it. And there's this concept, and Patricia alluded to this, called Fortress Russia. The idea that over years, Russia has made itself sanctions proof through its gold reserves and through its foreign exchange reserves. And what the White House and the EU and the Japanese and the Canadians wanted to do very specifically was bust that myth. They wanted to show Putin that that wasn't true. Now, if the end game is there to destabilize the Russian economy to lead to regime change, I'm not sure. But I think what they wanted to do more than anything else was to show Putin they could do it and instill a little fear and doubt in his mind. And by the way, on that front, it succeeded. He called an emergency meeting with his central bank governor right after this happened last week, Elvira Nabiullina, who's very well respected in the international monetary field. And you could see the concern and the strain on the entire central banking and the financial community. This was the first time, I think, since the beginning of the invasion and the lead up months ago, that Putin was caught off guard and the West had the initiative. Where this all leads, though, and what the West wants to achieve out of it, I still think is unanswered.
So, look, I will be fearless in sounding gauche or naive here, because the question that keeps pounding against the inside of my skull is, shouldn't there be a stated goal for unprecedented historic level of sanctions, and specifically it, because of the context that they were applied? I mean, Timothy Fry, A, should there be a goal, and B, or an explicitly stated one, and B, if you think so, what should that goal be?
A couple of points are in order. One is, it's not clear that even if the U.S. were to say these are the stated goals, and if you do X, the sanctions will come off. The Russians will believe that.
Right.
You know, Jackson Vanik was sanctions levied against Russia, the Soviet Union, I'm sorry, in 1975 for not allowing Jews to emigrate, in a word. They stayed on until 2012, well after the collapse of the Soviet Union, well after Jewish immigration had become a non-issue. So there's a deep skepticism among Russians that the sanctions are going to come off. There's also this notion of strategic ambiguity, where you want to keep the Russians guessing about what they need to do to try to relieve some of this pain. And that gives also the opportunity to respond to this very fluid battlefield situation that we're seeing. And, you know, the notion that you might want to lock yourself into one position today when positions on the ground might change tomorrow, you know, that might leave you at a disadvantage. So there's a logic into transparency of saying, yes, if you do X, we'll bring off the sanctions. But there's also a counter logic of that there are some benefits to keeping them vague as well.
Yeah. OK, so this is a really important point. Josh Lipsky, just let's play something out here. So say the international community were to express to Vladimir Putin total withdrawal of Russian forces from Ukraine, total and immediate withdrawal, would then relax certain sanctions. I completely hear what Timothy Fry is saying, that the Russians, and specifically Putin, would not believe that at all, because, I mean, look at Venezuela, look at Iran, as you mentioned earlier. I mean, we've had sanctions on Cuba for 60 years now. So what do you think of that?
Well, of course, you know, unlikely scenario, as we all know.
Yeah.
So it's not something being contemplated right now. But it can be held out. And, you know, in these situations that you compare to Iran, to Venezuela, to Cuba, a little different than the current situation, because here we have the invasion of a sovereign nation in Ukraine. And so if the if the holdout was, well, complete withdrawal of forces on all levels, including in Crimea, by the way, mm-hmm. and then we would begin relaxing sanctions, not only that were put on now, but going back to the 2014 sanctions in the original version, I think that is something that the U.S. would have to communicate clearly to the Russian people, which is very difficult right now, versus to Vladimir Putin. But let's be realistic. That's not the most likely outcome. Putin will never accept that. And he, through his propaganda machine, will tell the Russian people that this is not a real offer. So the most realistic outcome here is that the majority of these sanctions stay in place for a long time. But I just want to distinguish something from what was said earlier. It's true that other economies have experienced things like this, but an economy like Iran grew up with central bank sanctions for 20 years. They became integrated outside the global economy and their financial system. The Russians have been accustomed to a different standard of living and being part of international travel, international commerce. And I do think there's a unique pressure point applied here by switching that off for them overnight.
Timothy Fry, we just got about 30 seconds before our next break. Do you want to respond to that?
No, I think that's absolutely right. The extent to which these sanctions have caught the Russian people and the Russian elites off guard and caught Vladimir Putin off guard, you know, I think speaks to their real power and impact. And we'll have to see whether or not it leads to, you know, political pressure and what form that might take.
Well, Timothy Fry is a professor of post-Soviet foreign policy at Columbia University. Josh Lipsky, director of the Atlantic Council's Geoeconomics Center. We're talking this hour about the severity and impact of the financial penalties and sanctions that the international community has levied on Russia. As you heard earlier, Russian President Vladimir Putin calls it akin to economic war. We're taking a look at that idea, and we'll have more when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow, of course, we'll be continuing our coverage of the Russian attack, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and we're going to be taking a look specifically at the massive humanitarian catastrophe going on. Now, 2 million Ukrainian refugees, a number that's only going to get higher with every passing day. So we want to know, do you have family or friends, loved ones that you know in Ukraine who have fled their homes, who have made it across the border? Let us know what you're hearing from anyone that you know. If you are in Europe connected to the Ukrainian refugee crisis, what needs to be done to help stem or at least lessen, if possible, this humanitarian catastrophe? Call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. We'll be talking about the humanitarian and refugee crisis on tomorrow's show, and welcome your stories. Today, we're talking about the totality of the economic sanctions and financial penalties that the international community levied on Russia and what effect, if any, it will have. And I'm joined today by Josh Lipsky. He's director of the Atlantic Council's Geoeconomics Center. Timothy Fry is with us as well. He's a professor of post-Soviet foreign policy at Columbia University. And I wonder if you two could listen along with me, because we reached out to hear from someone about their firsthand experience of what sanctions do to the lives of ordinary people. Ksenia Gulyaeva is a freshman at Wesleyan University in Connecticut right now, and she's from St. Petersburg. So in 2014, she was in St. Petersburg when the international community slapped sanctions on Russia in response to its invasion of Crimea, Josh, as you had pointed out. And at the time, Ksenia was just 13 years old.
Everything became very, very expensive, and we couldn't afford traveling anymore. Electronics, for example, as we did it before. So ruble has fallen by half also at that time. It was really bad, but now the situation is worse.
Now, she says the fall of the Russian ruble's value has clearly increased the cost of everyday needs, food, energy, medicine, and more. And with many companies now also leaving Russia, there's added concern about unemployment.
For example, even just a cashier who works in IKEA now doesn't have any job. And my mother works in a hotel. I'm not sure that it influences her, but I'm afraid that it can.
Now, we mentioned Russia's ban from SWIFT, the global banking communication system. And Ksenia says that, too, will have a direct impact on her, even though she's here in the United States right now, and her friends.
For example, the parents of my friends have their money frozen and they simply cannot use it. Also, now they don't know how to pay for their studies abroad. Our families cannot transfer money to us. Of course, they worry about it because as students, we can't afford our living there by ourselves.
Now, as an international student, she says she could be in a difficult situation where she may need to choose between being able to see her family and staying in the United States because of complications with travel and renewing her visa.
But the main concern is not that I can't see my family, that I can't travel, that I don't have money because my parents can't send them. The main concern for me is just to stop the war in Ukraine. I understand that my problems are really nothing. Then people die. People don't have anything to eat. They can't buy products. They can't buy food. They can't leave a country. And they just have to hide. They have to fight with the Russian.
That's Ksenia Gulyaeva. She's a freshman at Wesleyan University in Connecticut, grew up and still has family in St. Petersburg. Timothy Fry, what did you hear in what she said?
So, you know, sanctions are a blunt tool, and ideally you would design them so that they don't hurt those Russians, in this case, who are against the war. But, you know, the currency is something that will cause pain on all. But looking beyond, I'm really glad that you identified someone from that generation, because I think the young Russians, the ones who opposed the idea of Fortress Russia and saw their future linked to the outside world, whether it was through vacations, through friendships, through, you know, going abroad for school or work, you know, this generation is so much more international than prior generations. And they're seeing their hopes and dreams really go up in smoke as the walls come down around them for those living in Russia. So there's a lot of Russians who are leaving Russia at the moment. And those who are staying are really having their whole lives, upended. So that is really, you know, the human tragedy here. And that's a generation that, I worry about.
Mm. Josh Lipsky, can sanctions be made any more of a precision instrument rather than the blunt instrument that we've been talking about? Or do they have to be so broad-based in order to be effective, however we're measuring effectiveness?
Well, first of all, I'd say, you know, I'm also really happy you brought that voice into the conversation, and the generational voice is important. And what I hear from what she said is someone who her and her friends will not accept over the long term being isolated from the global community. And I do think in a way that will weaken Putin. Now, the question about surgical precision and sanctions, the answer is they can be. And that is what we have done in other cases, including in 2014. And they didn't have the desired effect. So to exert maximum pressure here, we exerted a much more blunt instrument on the entire Russian economy. We did something that had never been done before because we wanted to respond in a way to what Putin had done. And that has collateral damage. All war does, to go back to your first point of whether it's war or not. And this is an example of collateral damage. But the decision was taken in the US and the European capitals and Japan as well, that we had to do something extraordinary beyond the precision instruments, beyond the specific targeting of oligarchs, which is still happening. We had to do something that was aimed at the ruble, that was aimed at the Russian economy, that was aimed at the heart of what Putin thought his strength was, his foreign exchange reserves, even though we knew that would have collateral damage. So we could do less. We decided to do something different.
Yeah. You know, I note that Ksenia very rightly, she says she understood, in a sense, in that last bit of tape you heard, she understood that while there may be suffering being laid upon the Russian people right now because of the sanctions, it doesn't at all hold a candle to the suffering that Russia is inflicting on the Ukrainian people. I mean, she said her priority is to stop the war. In fact, the war that's being waged in her name by Vladimir Putin. But Timothy Fry, again, I guess what I'm struggling with is sanctions are a preferred tool that we've seen used for decades now by the United States, by Europe, the members of the international community in multiple conflicts. But when we're talking about effectiveness, have any of them actually been effective?
So it's a really good question, and it's very difficult for academics to demonstrate this because each sanction case is so different. They each have different contexts. The scope and scale varies a lot, and there's so many other background factors that are taking place that it's difficult to isolate the impact of sanctions. And then again, we're dealing with the Russian case, which is just unprecedented to have sanctions of this size and scale on a economy as large as Russia's. But there's a few things to think about that I think are often underrated. Sanctions can be an important bargaining chip during negotiation periods. So having levied them prior to the conflict, this will be one tool that the West will use in negotiations with trying to reach a settlement with Russia. They also signal the perseverance, the willingness of the global community to express their outrage, much more so than if they had not used sanctions and just used, just tried to condemn them or just had a UN vote. Also, the sanctions are designed to really degrade the military capacity as well, to the extent that microprocessors and other high-tech goods are not getting to the Russian defense sector, that is also something that it needs to be appreciated. So, whether sanctions will work in the straight line way that many people think, that it just causes the elite to turn on President Putin for a decision that's causing them economic pain, that's not, we don't often see that. But in the totality of the, effects that sanctions have, I think one could make the case that, that they do change behavior.
No, that's an excellent point. In fact, and Josh Lipsky, we just got a question coming in that Timothy Fry might have already answered about, do sanctions reduce the ability of the Russian military war effort? Now, it might reduce the Russia's military capacity overall over time because of the, for example, the export bans that Professor Fry mentioned that will keep technology out of the hands of the Russian military sector. But would that have any impact in the short run, Josh?
It can, and so it can have just the basic financial distress that's happening in the Russian economy that can have an impact on how they're arming and equipping the military. And then if you think about airplanes and technology and all the things they need for the military that could over time degrade their capability that Putin is thinking about right now. And what I would say to the question about sanctions and deterrence, if we had not done this, it would have been a green light to Putin to do even more. So the fact that it hasn't stopped him is not necessarily a sign that it isn't working. If it gives pause, if it inflicts pain, if it prevents something worse from happening, that can be hard to measure, but can be an equally effective and important use of these sanctions.
Mm. I'm coming back to something that both of you have mentioned. And again, it has to do with trying to avoid inflicting sort of blanket suffering on people in a sanctions regime and doing more targeted economic actions. Certainly, there have to be some more. I mean, Josh, you had mentioned that already Putin has been rattled by the vulnerability of the ruble. I mean, that is a message that's gotten directly to him. Are there not other economic levers that would accomplish the same thing? But of course, now as I just asked the question, Josh, I realize that the ruble tanking has an effect on every Russian person as well. So scratch that. But save me from myself here. What do you think?
No. I mean, it's the one thing, you know, it's just back to your question, you know, what the White House wants. There's a reason the White House keeps saying take down the ruble. It's the one thing they could feel like went to the heart of Putin, struck at the core of what they thought was a strength. You know, Russian prided themselves on their fiscal and monetary policy over the last 20 years, especially since the 1998 financial crisis. This is going to be far worse than that for the Russian economy. So the targeting the ruble was intentional. There's nothing else quite like it, but there is more that can be done to harm the ruble. You know, on a scale of 1 to 10, we're only at 7 and 8 on the sanctions regimes. There are more banks that can be hit. There are secondary sanctions that can be put into place. So as extreme and unprecedented as this is, there's still more to do. And Putin and the central bank and the finance ministry know that as well.
The bizarreness of how prolonged sanctions, what effect, or if they're ever effective, around that question, because I'm noting that in the United States move now to ban Russian oil imports, it's reported, NPR reported that over the weekend, guess what? U.S. officials visited Venezuela to speak with Nicolas Maduro there to talk about energy security. Venezuela, a country that the United States has had sanctions on, blocking oil dealings and central banks there for years now. So again, effectiveness is something I'm just not going to stop thinking about here. But we've got about 3 minutes left, and we've focused quite a bit on government-levied sanctions. But Patricia Cohen at the top of the show mentioned something important, that individual corporations are also taking actions too. And they're not necessarily immediately under the thumb of the government, of international governments. I mean, Timothy Fry, is that a potentially double-edged sword, you think?
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of these companies are responding to the fear of dealing with actors who are on the sanctions list knowingly or unwittingly, which would then make them subject to sanctions as well. So there is an economic logic here linked to the sanctions. You know, Russia has done a lot to drive away foreign business in recent years. So many of the businesses that are pulling out, this is a small part of their operations. But I also know that some, particularly Russian business owners or, you know, affiliates of foreign companies within Russia, they also feel some responsibility to their employees. And they're, you know, arguing, you know, my employees were not involved in the decision to go to war with Ukraine, and many may even oppose it. But then again, they are, you know, suffering the consequences. And that is just the double-edged sword of sanctions that we've been, you know, talking about from, you know, from the beginning of the show.
Yeah. And also, I'm thinking in this modern world, you know, thinking back to Ksenia, the young Russian we heard from a little bit earlier, some of these companies, particularly the tech companies, may be more influential in the day-to-day lives of people, including in Russia, than even a central bank. So Josh, is this another layer of complexity that we need to think of about the consequences of actions by individual corporations in 2022?
It is, and it goes to the unprecedented issue we started with, because typically in the past, you know, the governments, Washington and Brussels and other, may levy these sanctions, but the private corporations will always figure out ways to continue to work with these companies if there's profits to be made, if there's business to be had. This is different. This is different from Apple. This is different from companies all around the world proactively saying we are removing ourselves, even though we're not necessarily subject to the sanctions. The connection between the financial and the political capitals around the world, I don't think we've ever seen something like this so swift. And this may have as much impact on the everyday Russians as the central bank sanctions.
Well, Josh Lipsky, director of the Atlantic Council's Geoeconomics Center, with us today from Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Timothy Fry, we've got 30 seconds left. I've got one more question, and I'd love to lean on sort of your historical knowledge here. Given what you know about the post-Soviet Union and Russia today, do you think the economic sanctions that we've been talking about all hour will have any impact on Vladimir Putin's decision-making right now regarding what he's doing in Ukraine?
Yes, certainly. The Putin has been able to stay in power by fending off these dual threats of coups and mass mobilization. And the collapse of the ruble and the financial sanctions make both of those challenges all that much more difficult. Whether it's enough to, you know, bring him down is an open question, but he won't be able to rule in the same way that he has done for the last 20 years.
Well, Timothy Fry, professor of post-Soviet foreign policy at Columbia University, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken? Wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.